Perfect. Hi, I'm Zoe. And before I begin, I want to thank and mention a couple of people, Dan Strebel and also Diane Little from Cenerec, because she and Cenerec, thanks to Dan who put us in touch, was able to make an internegative of this film. And as kind of the foster mother of this film, I was really delighted. So the internegative, the film original, and a DVD is now available at the National Library of Medicine. I donated that to them. So if you want to see more and look at this again, that's where you're going to be able to find it. I'm going to talk first. I'm going to try not to talk over the film because the film has a tremendous amount of intertitles, and I think the intertitles are really important. So it's kind of hard for me to talk and you read at the same time. But I wanted to mention Diane because she's going to step in shortly before 6 to maybe say something about the restoration of this film, whether the film is finished or not. We're going to show basically as much of the film as we have time for. Hopefully we'll certainly get through part one of the analysis. We may not get through all the way to part two. So, Child Analysis Parts 1 and 2, made in 1931 by the psychoanalyst L. Pierce Clark while he was a director of the Stanford Psychoanalytic Institute and Sanitarium. That's what we're going to see. But before I screen the film, I want to set the stage for a discussion of the complex relationship between scientific documentation and dramatic performance, a relationship often elided or hidden within the photographic image, with its claims to access to the real. This complexity is brought to the fore, I think, in so-called scientific images of mental disturbances, images that attempt to give the viewer access not just to the visible world, but beyond that, to the mental states of patients in front of the camera, their inner emotional life, something entirely intangible. I see Pierce Clark's film as an extraordinary elision of fact and fantasy, not just the purported fantasies of his patients, but those of the doctor himself. It's easy to think that the diagnosis of mental disturbance through the visual image is something that belonged to the world prior to psychoanalysis supplanting of the eye in favor of the ear. However, I want to show that this is an oversimplification. L. Pierce Clark's film reveals another side of therapy, one that some might want to sweep under the carpet or repress. That therapy is also the site of the staging of a drama in which analyst and analysand fight for control over a story or a script, and in extreme cases, the analyst provokes the drama itself. Let's look here at the opening intertitles of Child Analysis and consider what the doctor himself thought that he was showing us. The word dramatization is used several times in the opening titles. The first, dramatization by the motion picture camera, seems to imply a reenactment or docudrama, but this is a contemporary reading. In this film, we see the actual child patient with an analyst. To what extent both are performing for the director is a question that we can never know. The on-screen analyst is not Pierce Clark. It is a woman whose identity is never revealed. The implication is that the film shapes this encounter into a drama, that the medium itself dramatizes. The following slides, which you'll see again in the film, also use the word dramatization as in the phrase symbolic dramatization. This refers to the child's performance in a clinical theater in which he or she presents mental constructs symbolically for the camera. Here, the word dramatizes connotes both acting out and creating melodrama. But before we study the film in greater depth, let us look back at the history of the dramatization of mental disturbance, which can connote, on the one hand, as Pierce Clark points out, the patient's ability to find a dramatic form to reveal his or her problem, while on the other hand, it can so easily slide into, well, simply acting. How do we know one from the other? How can we read on the surface of the body the troubles of the mind? And how do we know that this performance is spontaneous and not consciously staged to please the therapist? Pierce Clark's films come from a tradition of both still and moving images of the insane that testify to the analyst's belief that mental disturbance could be manifest through physical enactment that could be captured photographically. To understand this tradition from a scientific perspective, one must go back to the writings of Descartes, who systemized the concept that the emotions were directly revealed by the body. And here we have the painter Charles Le Brun's depiction of the Cartesian passions in all their glory. Horror, fright, sadness, astonishment, ravishment, and awe. These images codified the idea that the passions impressed themselves on the human form as ideal templates. This concept influenced both studies of the insane and ideas about acting. 18th century theater scholar Aaron Hill based his simple four-step guide for actors on Cartesian physiology. He wrote, first comes the idea. Second, the idea appears on the face because it is nearest the seat of the imagination. Thirdly, impelled by the actor's will, a commissioned detachment of animal spirits inflates the appropriate muscles. Finally, the whole body automatically performs the expression, action, and vocal intonation appropriate to a particular passion without any further work on the part of the performer. Very simply, both doctors and theoreticians of drama both claimed that the body mechanically obeys an emotion. More than 100 years later, these ideas were enacted in the performances staged by the neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot at the Hospital of the Salpêtrière during his lectures on hysteria. Charcot hypnotized his women patients, then used the Faradaic stimulator to provoke expressions like anger and astonishment. Here, life was required to imitate art, and again the passion served as a template. After all, how could his audience know what anger looked like unless it had already been codified by artists like Le Brun and this codification duplicated by countless actors? Perhaps the most famous photographs from the Salpêtrière were those of the patient known as Augustine in the midst of her attacks of what was called La Grande Hysterie. The fact that these series of images were published in conjunction with transcripts of her delirious dialogues with people only she could see and hear made these documents into a kind of cinematic melodrama avant la lettre in the 1870s. And here's Augustine. To what extent she was consciously performing for the camera or to what extent she was in the thrall of her unconscious, we can never know. Providing visual evidence always connoted proving a certain mental state. It was a world where science met theater. Freud did not arrive at the Salpêtrière till 1886, but he must have been familiar with this case. The critical difference between Freud's psychoanalysis and the therapies practiced by the doctors of the Salpêtrière was that Freud actually listened to his patients with the idea with what they said might have something to do with what troubled them. Instead of showing or staging, Freud wanted to tell. His methods of attempting to present his patient's mental state was novelistic or literary rather than theatrical. To understand the films of Pierce Clark, one has to grasp how he was caught between showing and telling, the medical demonstration and the novelistic. He was born in 1870. He graduated from medical college in 1892. In 1896, he was appointed first assistant physician at the newly founded Craig Colony for Epileptics at Sarnia, New York. Shortly after Pierce Clark's departure, a series of films of epileptics were produced at the colony by Walter Greenock Chase and William Spratling in 1905. Each epilepsy biography, as it was called, was brief but alarming. I didn't bring them, actually, because many of you may be familiar with these epileptic seizures 1-9 from the Library of Congress paper print collection, where they're readily available. I would have imagined Clark would have known these films. However, they were produced for a different reason than Pierce Clark's child analysis. The epilepsy biographies were created to help doctors analyze the physical aspects of a seizure, while Pierce Clark's films attempted to elucidate the secrets of his patients' minds. Pierce Clark had a long-standing interest in explicating his ideas visually. I have found several examples of lectures he gave accompanied by lantern slides. In 1912, he presented a study of the significance of habit movements in mental defectives to the New York Psychiatric Society. And here is one of his lantern slides. I'm sorry, I had to take the reproductions from these little crummy pamphlets, and the quality was pretty awful. But you kind of get the idea. Here, images form a kind of visual codification that supports his text, which veers from a catalog of gesture to vague stabs at psychoanalytic interpretation. I quote from his text, "May not these types of habits then seem to be a continuance of neurotic infantile habits often perverted and enhanced by lack of physical and mental developments in the imbecile and idiot class?" The second series of lantern slides are most clearly theatrical. Second series that I found, I don't know if there are more, are clearly theatrical. Indeed, they are documents of theater as therapy. These images come from his paper, An Experimental Study in Mental Therapeutics, delivered to the New York Psychiatric Society in 1919, showing the treatment of nervous invalids through a Montessori education with a special focus on rhythmic dancing. And here are the nervous invalids. I particularly like their little titles, A Serenade. The relaxation exhibited is very noteworthy. The Patriarch, and here we have the Water Dance. Here, as you can see, the nervous invalids are shown cavorting in a pastoral setting that recalls the neoclassical paintings of Puvis de Chavannes. The costumes and poses allow the viewer to imaginatively enter into a fantasy world where mental disturbance has been banished. In its place, we find an Arcadian idyll. But whose fantasies are these, the doctor or the patients? It is a question that will be very pertinent to the scenarios of Pierce Clark's films. His titles, I think, are really worthy of note. I particularly like this one, The Three Types of Cases, which I really think should read Graces. It is clear he sees his patients in just as strongly aesthetic terms as Charcot himself, who used to declare that his hypnotized hysterics would make superb models for artists. Throughout his career, Pierce Clark was to work with both epileptics and mentally retarded patients. However, his treatment of mental disorder shifted from the medical to the psychoanalytic. Though he was not alone in making this transition, his approach was colorful and unorthodox. He embraced this new discipline with great zeal. In 1908, he gave the New York Neurological Society a report on Freud's method of psychotherapy. By 1912, he was treating epileptics with psychoanalysis with what he considered great success. He even developed a general theory that the patient's convulsive disorders were unconsciously aimed to produce gratification. By the 1920s, he was in touch with some of the most important psychoanalysts of his day. He prepared an edition of Anna Freud's Introduction to the Techniques of Child Analysis for publication through the Nervous and Mental Diseases Publishing House until her associate, Ernest Jones, put a stop to this. Pierce Clark's interest in child analysis, indeed, that of Anna Freud and Melanie Klein, was very startling since their work was barely known outside Europe at this time. In fact, when I contacted the New York Psychoanalytic Library and told them about this film, they just thought I was making the whole thing up. They said nobody in 1930 was interested in child analysis in this country. I must have the date completely wrong. However, he was more than simply a follower of this new discipline. He had ideas of his own. His friend, the Hungarian analyst Sándor Ferenczi, wrote to Freud that Piers Clark had developed a new technique he called forced fantasies. He pointed out that, this is Piers Clark, pointed out that Freud could not treat certain types of patients because he believed they were not open to transference. These patients, Piers Clark labeled narcissists. His category included schizophrenics, manic depressives, psychotics, drug addicts, homosexuals, paranoids, and those suffering from melancholy, dipsomania, and epilepsy. In a sense, one could say that for Piers Clark, psychoanalysis was a new cure-all, the equivalent of a wonder drug. Piers Clark advocated his fantasy method in the treatment of these so-called narcissists. This technique involved a mild self-hypnosis, not unlike daydreaming. He insisted that his patients come up with fantasies referable to their earliest childhood. He noted that these fantasies should not be confused with actual memories. He believed that they were nonetheless psychologically true. Initially, the analyst was to interpret as little as possible, allowing the narcissist to reach for the outer world. At least that was a theory. Clark begins his film Child Analysis on an optimistic note with the title, "This film is self-explanatory." But it quickly becomes clear that Piers Clark wants to keep his slippery image under tight control of a text that always spells out what we're about to see and much more. This was typical of all visual psychological documentation from the earliest photographs of the insane, which were always accompanied by explanatory titles, to doctor's voiceover that accompany modern DVDs on mental disturbance. The image is never allowed to speak for itself. As you will see in Piers Clark's film, the camera is fixed at the side of the bed. There are a few pans, but no close-ups or reverse angles. The view is oddly flattened. Perhaps, though I'm not sure, it might have been shot through a one-way mirror. This awkward angle connotes something of a private detective capturing the evidence of an illicit affair. Indeed, the subject matter, particularly the second part showing a young man and female therapist wrestling on a bed, does nothing to dispel this. What we see is both flattened and affectless visually, while at the same time highly overwrought in the description provided by the titles. The titles in part one speak of the analyst mother, a direct reference to the work of Melanie Klein, who addressed childhood sexual anxiety through analyzing the symbolism of children's play. Klein was unafraid to confront the child's transference feelings towards her as a therapist mother. In doing so, she showed how children exhibited intense love, hate, and jealousy towards their own mothers. However, Piers Clark had his own very peculiar interpretation of her ideas. What we actually see in his film is quite different. In Child Analysis, we discover a game of role reversal, where the analyst plays the part of the epileptic little girl, Winnie, under the direction of Winnie playing the part of the mother. So the analyst plays the patient, and the patient plays the mother. Or so Piers Clark's intertitles claim. As a little girl patient seems to lose interest in this game, the therapist acts the part of the child with increasing and rather alarming alacrity. A title announces the next part of the play in which Winnie attempts a cannibalistic ingestion of the analyst mother and vice versa. One wonders what Winnie thinks of this odd woman who does not act like a mother, but instead seems to masochistically enjoy allowing herself to be tormented by a child. Part two of Child Analysis is structured the same way with the same female analyst. Again, the films begin with titles, Ned, an epileptic boy aged 19, note, maternal identification fixed at the passive homoerotic level. He dramatizes the latter by a game in which he alternately plays a part of a little girl and a little boy. Both roles are bound to mother identification. The fact that Ned is actually a young man of 19 rather than a child definitely adds a certain tension to this bedroom scenario. However, the Oedipal ramifications of sleeping with the analyst mother seems not to have occurred to Pierce Clark. The next title reads, Ned whispers directions for the analyst mother to place a woman's wig on his head. He bids her lean over. The clumsy performances, poor lighting, amateurish cinematography, and rigid camera focused on the bed in both cases is very close, in some ways, to the look of stag films from the era of the 1930s. Without the titles, one might believe we are watching the clumsy seduction of an older woman by a young man. What we see connotes not the play acting of a child, but rather the private staging of an erotic scene. As our previous presenter, Linda Williams, points out in her book on pornographic cinema, the amateurism of the stag film is a kind of guarantee of the real, a reassurance that the show is no act. The same holds true here. We believe that these people are not faking it because they are so clumsily presented. At the same time, the role of the analyst works to force the patient to confess, as it were, his desires, to act them out. It seems that Ferenczi was not far off his mark when he described Pierce Clark's method as forced fantasies. From his writings, it's clear that Pierce Clark was aware that his method diverged from Anna Freud and Melanie Klein, whose names he invokes in his intertitles. However, his explanation for taking a different approach to treatment was that the children in his care were developmentally retarded. He claims that Winnie had a mental age of 5 years, 8 months, and Ned a mental age of 9 and a half. They had developed only the wrath of an Oedipus relationship, he wrote, and thus transference was almost impossible. Reading that Winnie and Ned are developmentally retarded after seeing the film comes as a shock. It is something that's simply impossible to gauge visually. We know that Clark showed these films to the New York Neurological Society on February the 3rd, 1931, shortly before his death. He also wrote about the two films in essays on child analysis and Child Analysis, a Motion Picture Dramatization. Thus, his presentation probably had direct bearing on how this film was understood. I don't believe that it was circulated without him. In his essays, Clark discusses how his patient's epileptic performances may have epilepsy may have been caused by emotional conflicts. He advocates that mental arrest should be presented in terms of Freud's libidinal theory, as he had begun to do in his Lantern Lectures on Idiots in 1912. He explained that the procedures used in the film consisted of a more abundant giving of love, a more active participation in analysis than would ordinarily be the case. But one may ask, and this is my last paragraph before we screen, one may ask, who is the author of the sadomasochistic fantasy of eating and being eaten, so remarkably similar in both cases of Winnie and Ned, and enacted with so much alacrity by the woman on the bed? I believe that the film you're going to see shows little but tells everything. On one level, it could be described as a failure, a cinematic dead end, based on the chimerical enterprise of reading on the body that which exists in the mind. But on another level, I believe it's interesting exactly because the film can be read as a confession in the sense that Foucault refers to in his book, History of Sexuality, An Introduction. Here, Foucault argues against the idea that sexuality was repressed in the 19th century. Instead, he shows how it was constantly searched out and transformed into discourse. This feverish incitement to investigate sexuality grew out of the Catholic confession, but instead of just priests, doctors now required their patients, especially those with nervous disorders, to confess their sexual desires. I believe this film speaks loudly and clearly of the doctor's pleasure of discovering and exposing the so-called truth of sexuality, his desire to provoke and uncover and, of course, capture it on film. So with that, let's screen.
for a quick Q&A. Questions? Julia.
Okay. Oh, this is a question for Zoe. I don't think you said this, but where did you initially find out about these films, and where did you find them? I know you said where they have gone now.
Where did they come from?
Yeah.
The simple answer is eBay. I saw a picture of a rusty can. It said Stanford Psychoanalytic Sanitarium 1926, which was what was written on the can. And I was like, that's for me. And that's all I knew. And I got the film, and I had it was clearly the original, because it was the titles were like hand cement spliced onto the rest of the film. I mean, it was Reversal Original. And the date I could find out the date on the side was like actually 1930. And I immediately wrote back to the person who I bought it from and said, do you know anything about this? And they said, nah, I got an estate sale in Pennsylvania, know nothing about this. And it really wasn't it was really the archivist at the New York Psychoanalytic Library that helped me kind of put this together, and we discovered it was Pierce Clark, and he had written about the films and so on. And I found his writing.
Anyone? Okay.
Let me ask the other two, Snowden, to respond to this issue, the ethical issues raised by the films we looked at, but then the same issues, the kind of dubious provenance and unknown provenance of films about mental health on eBay and the Internet. Do you want to address that any more specifically, having seen what we just saw and set up for your own film?
I would be interested to know whether I know of at least one person who I think is in this room. Albert, are you in here? Albert Speck? I know of at least one other instance where an observational film of juvenile subjects during in a clinical setting, children who are under observation and obviously had evident developmental disabilities, were purchased on eBay by somebody who told me that he felt uncomfortable having the films, and that they were clearly part of some sort of human studies research that which, as I'm sure people are aware, are those human studies research projects are usually governed by very strict rules, and the records that are gathered and retained in the course of that research are not supposed to find their way out onto eBay. One of the issues that I had in mind in proposing this talk is the idea that, you know, the rules do get broken and stuff does find its way out onto eBay, and there is no community standard, whether you're talking about film archives or the film collectors world or on eBay generally, for how those materials are happened. The collector in question told me that he felt bad about having the films, didn't feel comfortable watching them, that I wonder if they were as hard to watch as Zoe's film was for me to watch, but I can certainly understand wanting to let go of that material and not have it in your possession, but also as a collector wanting to recoup your financial investment. His solution was to sell it to a doctor. That's as responsible as any other solution I could come up with. The archivist in me is reluctant to see anything destroyed that it has found its way into my hands, but I do also honor the agreement that may have been made between patient and practitioner that the records are made under controlled circumstances for a specific use, and that they may not find an audience outside of that, and should not. So I don't have answers for that. I'd be very interested if anybody here, maybe from one of the scientific institutions, has encountered material of this nature, if there are institutional policies that govern how those materials are managed, released, and accessed after their original purpose is met. Anybody? That's my question to you guys. Rick? Oh, somebody back here?
I was basically wondering the same thing, and if the HIPAA regulations governing the medical establishment now, how has that been applied to films of this type?
I don't know that it has. I think that's the issue, that the medical community generally has not seemed to have dealt with their archival materials well, to the point where they deny the possibility of existence of materials that are in archive hands. So the state of affairs is entirely reactionary from what I can see, that the materials have been sort of rediscovered after having been created, and there isn't a plan at the time of their creation for their long-term management. Only one of the studies that I've looked at in depth on home movies in studying autism and schizophrenia, only one of them mentions, and only in passing, the idea of the creation of an archive of films for studies. Those home movie studies are usually are voluntary participation by the subjects. The authors go through autism journals, support groups, medical journals, professional organizations, and they solicit films from people who are willing to participate in the study. I don't even know where they get their control footage of quote-unquote normal children. That's a question there, but there seems to be obvious value in the retention of these records so that, say, those earliest studies from the 1960s where the authors are saying, as I said, some very harsh things about people's parenting skills and their handling of their own children in a very, very narrow and non-representative slice of their lives. It would be very interesting, I think, for us to be able to revisit that footage in a different way, or with a certain amount more objectivity, looking for quantitative information rather than qualitative information. And I don't know that there's any facility for doing that. The next step, I suppose, is to get in touch with the researchers and find out what they think they're doing and what steps they've taken.
Howard?
As a university professor, I am required, even if I do a questionnaire for adults, I am required to go through a whole human process, human protection process. I have to do training. I have to get it approved by a panel. And I have to assure them that any data that I collect cannot be traced back to the individuals who participate in that, even and particularly with, it's particularly harsh for minors. Mm-hmm. And even with informed consent, I have to separate out the anything that might identify. I can keep data, but I have to give, there's whole procedures for giving patient number or, you know, I don't deal with patients, obviously. Questionnaire number 352 has this kind of characteristics and answered the question in this kind of way. But no way to link that back to the person. So the equivalent with a film would probably be blocking out the face or, you know, doing something like that so that there's no way of identifying. Now, that's been the practice for at least the last 15, 20 years. Those regulations don't say a whole lot about records that were gathered earlier. And that's where, you know, some of this really comes up, but we couldn't gather things like this today. I mean, you have to show how you're going to destroy these things and how you're going to move the link, remove the link between the data and the anything identifiable, traceable back to a person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's now, and it seems like this. We're also dealing with what was then, so very different worlds.
This, as far as I understand it, this is not a new question for the archival community. At AMIA back in the early 90s, we had somebody from the General Counsel's office at the Smithsonian come to speak on analysis of the rights of human subjects as in historical film and unedited footage. And there's been a lot of work on this. Pam Wintle would be a good person, because the ethnographic film community has been dealing with this for quite a while. And that obviously includes a lot of medical related materials. I think it's just the world is a lot noisier now. And as you say, a lot of records and documents are leaking out.
Thank you.
Quick announcement. Got one more? Carl, please. Last question from Carl.
Well, it's just a couple of observations. One, 20 years later, Gregory Bateson and a team did the famous Natural History of an Interview. That was a detailed analysis of a few seconds of interaction between Gregory and a patient. And that was just such an incredible bit of research, but it's never been allowed out of the archives in University of Chicago because of exactly these kinds of problems. I'd also make the observation that this footage is just extraordinarily horrible in the sense, from a scientific standpoint, that what Bateson and all the people who did the nonverbal interaction communication work, analysts and anthropologists and so forth, were using the camera, as we've talked about again and again in the last few days, to go beyond where the naked eye was able to see in micro-analysis. And this is not only taken the normal stream of at actual speed, but it's chopped it up into completely unintelligible little chunks. And it's hard to imagine how anything could come out of what we've seen on the screen. And I think it would be interesting to look in comparison with what everyone from Gregory Bateson to Chuck and Candy Goodwin and their conversation analysis have been able to do.
I think this film is interesting. Well, I think it's interesting in a lot of ways. But it shows us a kind of a snapshot of what people thought they were doing with psychoanalysis, which it may not be good science, but it's kind of amazing to watch this. I mean, I'd never heard of analysts wrestling around with their child patients.
That was a standard procedure?
No, I think it was Pierce Clark's, I think, his own particular kind of interpretation, but I think psychoanalysis was kind of it was out there and it was being invented on the spot, and people had all kinds of different interpretations, and it's one of them, you know, that people didn't, as I say, that when I told the library about this film, they just thought I was fantasizing, and they didn't, until I said, listen, I'm bringing my DVD and my computer, and you're going to see this, because they just would not believe it. Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting kind of record of a part of a whole continuum, what I was trying to show, of the idea of documenting mental disturbance photographically since the mid-19th century, which in it itself is a fascinating practice. And the fantasies of the doctors are just as interesting as those of the purported patients. I think what people think they imagine they see, think they see, believe, what they think photography or cinema is really is what interests me. Whether it's good or bad science, I'm less concerned about it.
Doctors can be mentally ill too, right? before you withhold your applause, I'm going to ask you to thank the panel in a minute, but let me just make this quick announcement as we leave. We want to leave now so we can catch the sunset at the top of Carolina. You'll be directed toward it if you don't know where it is, but it's just a short walk away. Dinner and drinks tonight are on Peter Lindbergh, thanks to Haga Film. Thank this panel.